It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Let's talk about two big international crises that we're in the middle of right now with implications for America and the world. The oil tanker attacks in a key shipping lane in the Middle East yesterday. That was Richard's lead story on the news just now, and which has many people worried that we could be on the brink of an actual U.S.-Iran war. And the ongoing protests and crackdown in Hong Kong. President Trump, with his eye on his relationship with China's authoritarian leader Xi Jinping, is not taking a clear stand for freedom of speech and Hong Kong's political rights.
I hope it all works out for China and for Hong Kong.
Are they sending a message to China with these demonstrations?
I don't know what they're sending. I mean, that's a demonstration that they're having. I understand the reason for the demonstration, but I'm sure they'll be able to work it out.
And that's a very different tone than what Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said on behalf of the administration regarding who attacked the oil tankers.
The Islamic Republic of Iran is responsible for the attacks that occurred in the Gulf of Oman today. This assessment is based on intelligence, the weapons used, the level of expertise needed to execute the operation, recent similar Iranian attacks on shipping, and the fact that no proxy group operating in the area has the resources and proficiency to act with such a high degree of sophistication.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo yesterday. With us now, Washington Post foreign affairs correspondent Ishan Tharoor, who's writing about both stories this week. He has been previously based in Hong Kong, too. So thanks for doing this, Ishan. Welcome back to WNYC.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
By way of background first on the oil tanker attacks, you described the Strait of Hormuz, where this took place, as possibly the world's most pivotal maritime corridor. Why is it so pivotal?
Well, to put it plainly, it's where a lot of the world's oil comes out of. Something like a fifth of all global oil exports travel through and from over the Strait of Hormuz to the rest of the world. And of course, for countries like Iran, it is a crucial artery for their economy.
Iran denies that they attacked the oil tankers, but we heard the evidence, a little bit of it as laid out in that clip from Secretary Pompeo. Is there much doubt among leaders that Iran did this?
There is a sort of cautious certainty that Iran is probably behind it. But I would caution against automatically assuming that it's Tehran that did this. We still don't know exactly what these devices were that were used in the explosion. We don't know their provenance. The Iranians, of course, are adamant that they have nothing to do with this. And, you know, indeed, they've been circulating images of their own ships putting out the fires on some of these tankers that were attacked. They rescued some of these sailors who were on these tankers. So they're trying to argue that they're being framed by other forces in the region.
It's a very serious thing, attacking oil tankers that are engaged in international shipping. I mean, this is sort of why the U.S. went to war against Iraq in the first place in 1991. They were cutting off oil supply, you know, and dominating it by invading Kuwait, the oil-rich country down there. I know this is much smaller than that, but this is very, very serious. What would Iran's or anyone's motive be for harming these tankers or baiting the U.S. into a war?
Well, what we're seeing right now, obviously, is the consequence of the United States pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal and slapping on sanctions on Iran, specifically sanctions that have targeted now Iran's oil exports, which are crucial for the country's economy. And you have had Iranian officials say that if this waterway, if the Strait of Hormuz is not delivering dividends to us that help our economy, why is it in our interest to keep it safe? So there's a suggestion here that this is how Iran strikes back. It does these kind of mysterious, murky attacks that you can't fully pin on them by way of exerting a bit more pressure against what they feel is an asphyxiating regime of sanctions put on them by the United States.
These were Japanese tankers that were attacked. And Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was visiting Iran right at that moment, trying to de-escalate tensions. It's so brazen in that respect. But it doesn't answer the question who did it. The Iranians and also some more left-leaning analysts are using a Gulf of Tonkin analogy. That is, that's a Vietnam War reference, an attack that turned out to be a U.S. pretext for escalating that conflict back in the 1960s. Can you decipher whether there are any other possible players who gain from an attack like this?
Yes, I mean, the Gulf of Tonkin was definitely discussed a lot yesterday after we saw these tankers. And after we saw the speed with which Secretary Mike Pompeo immediately came out and accused Iran of doing this. Don't forget that there were earlier attacks last month, also sort of off the coast of the United Arab Emirates, that are similar to this. I think if Iran did this, the calculation that it's making is that it's hazy and murky enough that it wouldn't necessarily provoke real military reaction from other powers. The Iranians, of course, point the finger to other forces. They are, you know, in the region, they have profound enmity with Saudi Arabia, with the UAE, and so they accuse, you know, other forces that are very close to the United States of perhaps enabling these kind of sabotage attacks that make Iran look bad. About Shinzo Abe, of course, as you said, it was one Japanese tanker and then the other tanker was a Norwegian one.
Uh-huh.
But it was incredibly embarrassing for Shinzo Abe, who had this two-day mission to Iran, the first time any Japanese prime minister had come to the Islamic Republic since 1979. And he was really there to present himself as a kind of international statesman, a potential mediator between Iran and the United States. And it didn't seem to go down very well. First of all, he clearly tried to deliver a message from Trump to the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, and Khamenei didn't want any part of that. And then, of course, whatever Abe achieved in attempting to translate, you know, some certain messages that could possibly help ratchet down tensions was swept away by the events that we saw in the Gulf of Oman.
Tweet from a listener says, interesting how the intelligence community is to be believed by Trump when they support an administration position, unlike his position toward them when they come up with stuff on Russia. That is an interesting dichotomy. Listeners, we can take phone calls on either of these stories. We've been talking about the Iran situation so far, but anyone with connections to Hong Kong listening right now, you're invited to call in and tell everyone else how you see what's happening there right now and why it matters. And anyone with a comment or question about the escalation of tensions between the U.S. and Iran, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Ishan Tharoor, foreign affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. And before we pivot to Hong Kong, just one more question on Iran. Are there camps in the White House for escalation or de-escalation? I think we've heard previously, even before these incidents, that National Security Advisor John Bolton is a big hawk. He's been pushing war with Iran for many years, and Trump is not. And I don't know where Pompeo, the Secretary of State, who sounded very hawkish yesterday, fits into that equation. Do you have reporting that indicates that there's an active debate about literally whether to go to a war with Iran?
It's incredibly complicated, but yes, to put it quickly, President Trump isn't exactly as like-minded as John Bolton. For John Bolton, Iran has been a hobby horse of the past two decades. Specifically, regime change in Iran has been something he has supported. Mike Pompeo, in early iterations of his political career, was also quite strident on Iran, but doesn't seem to be as hawkish. But right now, you know, when you have Trump himself on Fox News decrying this nation of terror, it doesn't sound like that much as the Trump who we heard heard about in private discussions chastising Bolton for driving the country to war. It seems that they're reading more closely from the same script right now. And we don't know exactly what that script is. We know that it's in nobody's real interest to start a war, but they have enabled a certain moment of volatility that the Iranians are also playing a part into that could trigger a series of actions that take us down a pretty dangerous course. What the Trump administration is very insistent on is that this campaign of maximum pressure that they have put upon the Islamic Republic is working, that, you know, they're really squeezing the Iranian economy, they're pressuring the regime to change its actions. But a lot of experts and analysts of Iran say say that rather than, you know, coercing Iran to change its behavior in the rest of the Middle East, it's only making Iran more volatile and provocative. And so this is another debate that's happening now in Washington. Is the current course, that diplomatic course that the White House has taken, is this itself a kind of ruinous and dangerous act?
Hong Kong. What people have been hearing in the news is that there have been massive protests of up to 1 million people against a law that would allow extraditions to mainland China. And I wonder if you could give our listeners who may not know the basics of this history a little Hong Kong 101, because Hong Kong isn't just another city in China. There's a different political relationship and a different, really a different political and cultural background, right?
Absolutely. Hong Kong, of course, is a former British colony that was administered by the British for over a century, and it was handed back to China in 1997 under a certain set of arrangements. That Hong Kong maintains its own court system, it maintains its own customs, it maintains its own economic system and currency, and maintains its own legal system, as I said. And this has enabled Hong Kong to stand apart from China, to be a place where lots of foreign companies and come to do business under systems that are more transparent and business friendly. And it's really made Hong Kong into Asia's financial capital. And so this system has been the system that's existed since 1997. Now, of course, there have always been fears ever since Hong Kong was transferred over to China that even under the arrangement, this one country, two systems model that exists, that the Chinese over time will steadily squeeze that system and further erode Hong Kong's civil liberties. It's right in Hong Kong, you have freedom of speech, you have a limited form of democracy there that is a source of huge debate within Hong Kong. You have free press, you have an incredibly vibrant civil society. And in recent years especially, that has come under significant pressure. And so what you're seeing now are the biggest protests you've seen in Hong Kong for the past half a decade. And the extradition law, you know, on one level you'd say, okay, it seems right that Hong Kong should not be a safe haven for criminals fleeing China or Taiwan or other places, and that they should have these treaties. But the fear for somebody sitting in Hong Kong who is worried about Chinese influence is that once this extradition law is in place, it would give Beijing the ability to chill dissent, enact court cases that intimidate dissidents and silence free speech, and further exercise its control over the city.
Your article on this is headlined, "How Hong Kong Protests Play into Trump's Showdown with China." What's the relationship?
Well, of course, at the end of this month, Trump is heading to the G20 summit in Japan. We don't know right now if Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping will meet. But of course, all eyes are going to be on that meeting if it happens. We're in a very complicated and tense moment in the U.S.-Chinese trade war. And there are suggestions that the U.S. is really hoping to leverage what they already have on China, these tariffs, its squeezing of the Chinese company Huawei, into convincing Xi Jinping to sit down and make some real concessions. Now, Hong Kong, of course, is a human rights issue. It's something that, you know, previous American administrations saw Hong Kong as the template for what China should be. That is no longer the case, certainly under Xi Jinping, who's become an incredibly authoritarian figure in Chinese political history. And Trump himself has not really voiced very much support for Hong Kong, its human rights situation. Trump has said nothing on a larger level about China, about China's human rights issue, least of all, and most importantly, about, say, the 1 million plus people who are in re-education, quote-unquote re-education camps in the far western region of Xinjiang. These are Muslim minorities, largely. Trump has said nothing about that, even though his administration has been quite strong on it. So human rights do not play a part in Hong Kong's message, in Trump's messaging. But what could be interesting, and we're seeing some debate now about this both on the Hill and within the administration, is that, as I was saying earlier, Hong Kong has this special status. It has a unique system. If Congress could rule, The United States could determine that if this extradition law passes, Hong Kong is not sufficiently autonomous enough for the United States to recognize its own independent structures and to do business there. And that could have profound, profound ramifications for the Hong Kong economy and for the Chinese economy. It's a kind of nuclear button that Trump could press to really pressure China. But the problem with that is that it would have ramifications for everybody, including ordinary Hong Kongers, who you don't really want to be punishing.
Adam in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Adam.
Hi. I lived in Hong Kong. My wife and I lived there for a couple of years, actually just leading up to the pro-democracy protests of 2014. And we got to know a lot of folks there. We loved Hong Kong. It is an amazing city. And we felt very much, and we actually moved to Hong Kong from New York and have since moved back to New York from Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And I can say that we actually listened to your show from there and continue to support WNYC.
Yay, thank you.
And so, yeah, we very much appreciate being able to stream. But we were very moved when we were there and have continued to be moved by the struggle of the folks there. It is very much, as has been described here, the relationship with China is a very unusual one, because people flow so freely from Hong Kong to China, and a lot of people's livelihoods depend upon that flow. But the tension is profoundly there. And I think that at the time that we were there and leading up to the pro-democracy protests, there was very much a sense in the atmosphere that was tense, but was more positive about Hong Kong's relationship with China and the possibility that it might sort itself out, because a lot of the pro-democracy protests was about a timetable for people to have actual elections, for a democratic election across the population of the chief executive, basically they're being able to vote for their own mayor. And that got squashed by the Beijing government. And we visited since 2014, and the mood was very much down compared to the time that we were there, because everyone had come out in the streets and they thought that there was a chance that they could push Hong Kong to a more democratic place. There was a lot more shrugging of people's shoulders when we had returned, and this was a couple of years ago.
Yeah. And did you get the sense when you returned that there was a lot of disappointment in Xi Jinping? I was in China in 2012, just after he had taken office, or just as the transition was underway, and the people I spoke to there who were more pro-democracy were kind of hopeful that he would continue the trajectory of reforms, and he's in fact done just the opposite. So I wonder if you got that sense of disappointment in Xi Jinping compared to what they thought he was going to be in Hong Kong.
Definitely. And it's a kind of a combination, because I think that the strongest disappointment comes for the members people like Carrie Lam, like the Hong Kong chief executive, and the members of the Hong Kong community, oftentimes the business community, who are selected by Beijing to be kind of Beijing's representatives within the Hong Kong government. And the strongest disappointment is against that slice of Hong Kong government that's hand picked by Beijing.
Yeah, which they have the power to do. Adam, thank you so much. We'll have to take a break. We'll continue in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're on WNYC as we have a few minutes left with Ishan Tharoor, Washington Post foreign correspondent, who's writing about two major crises in the world right now, the rising tensions with Iran on the basis of many things, but certainly the attacks on two oil tankers in the Middle East this week that the U.S. is at least blaming on Iran, and also the ongoing crisis in Hong Kong with a million or so demonstrators in the street and the kind of independence of that somewhat democratic bastion within China being threatened right now. And let's take a phone call. Barry in Sunnyside, you're on WNYC. Hi, Barry.
Hi, thanks. I'm no Iranian apologist and at least not usually a conspiracy theorist guy, but after I heard Pompeo say his piece, I thought to myself, gee, there are definitely other countries who have the capability to do that and with more of a reason to do so. I thought of Israel and Saudi Arabia. Obviously, Israel wants us to have more of a reason to go after
You're talking about a false flag attack to try to bait the U.S. into a war with Iran.
I hate to admit it, but that immediately came to my mind. Stranger things have happened. What does your guest say?
And Ishan, I can tell you that Barry is not the only caller on the board with that theory,
mm-hmm.
or at least suspicion.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I was in a sit-down with a bunch of other journalists with Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif in New York a couple of months ago. And the Iranian line is that everything that's happening is to be blamed on what they call the four Bs. That is John Bolton sitting in the White House, Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, and then Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia and Mohammed bin Zayed of the United Arab Emirates. They see this kind of axis against them, capable of all sorts of dastardly behaviors, trying to foment war and regime change in Iran. This is, of course, a very convenient narrative that the Iranians push, and the Iranians have plenty of previous in terms of sabotage attacks and sort of various destabilizing maneuvers, both in the waterways and as well as, you know, as we're seeing right now in Yemen and Saudi Arabia. So, again, I understand people's skepticism. I do think that the Trump administration, by nature of its own messaging on a whole number of issues, has diminished credibility in the eyes of many people. But the consensus, not just among U.S. officials, but also other Western governments, does still seem to be that the Iranians are the most likely actors here.
Let's say it was Iran. Can we avoid this becoming the U.S. versus Iran, Trump versus Ali Khamenei? Which would be the worst thing for the United States, I think, as opposed to the international community, maybe through the UN, enforcing against Iranian aggression. Because really, when you're talking about oil tankers going through the Strait of Hormuz, it has implications for the whole world.
Right. So if this was Iran, I think the calculation that the Iranians are making is that, or at least certain elements within the Iranian regime are making, because, again, it's not, there isn't exactly a clear power structure where the foreign minister knows exactly what the Iranian Revolutionary Guards is doing. The calculation that they're making is that, look, we can do these target attacks that squeeze and add pressure but don't necessarily trigger the kind of escalation that would put our own security and regime at risk. And as far as we're seeing right now in terms of an international response, there's been discussion of more military naval patrols of tanker shipping, but not much more than that. There have been a lot of calls now for an international investigation, as you said, and that probably should be the basis of how things go forward and how this incident gets translated into the sort of the international diplomatic space. But we'll see, you know, what more the U.S. does. There have been, of course, over the past couple of months, renewed additional reinforcements sent by the United States to the region in moves that have been read as saber rattling. But we don't know at present if the Trump administration is really contemplating anything more that could be interpreted as an escalatory move.
Has Trump's go-it-alone foreign policy, including his hostility to Western European leaders, left us without Western allies for this? Or does none of that matter when something so globally threatening as an Iran attack on oil tankers, if it was Iran, leave all that as irrelevant, and then a coalition would form around the particular instance?
I think it's much more the former. The Trump administration has really infuriated the Europeans over the past 2 years, basically, on its sort of very willful shredding of the Iran deal. You weren't seeing these kinds of attacks in off the Strait of Hormuz before the Iran deal was abrogated by the U.S. And the Europeans are incredibly frustrated by sort of the strategic thinking that they're seeing in Washington. They don't really understand what the point of pulling out of the Iran deal was. It sets back, in their view, the ability to constrain and contain Iran on all the fronts that the United States wants to, because now we're also seeing Iran possibly be reviving nuclear enrichment, since they have no reason to stay in the nuclear deal either. So it's created problems. It hasn't solved any, and the Europeans are not exactly they're not really inclined to go along with Pompeo and Trump on any kind of particularly confrontational stance.
One more call. Let me go right to line 7 there. Evan in Manhattan on Hong Kong. Evan, we have a minute left. Hi.
Oh, yeah. I just want to make a quick observation. In 2014, there was the Umbrella Movement, which occupied Hong Kong's business district and two other places for 79 days. And the organizers of that peaceful demonstration were just sentenced to imprisonment in April. So there are two university professors, Benny Tai and Chen Kim Man, and one legislator, Xiu Ka Chun. And so they were thrown into jail in April. And then they call on people to come onto the street to protest the extradition law, because that will destroy this firewall between Hong Kong and China in terms of the rule of law. And so more than a million people took to the street on Sunday. But then on June 12th, there was a second Occupy that appeared have all these young people blocking the entryway to the Legislative Council to prevent them from voting. And all of a sudden, now they thrown all this leadership into jail, but still people spontaneously come out to protest. So I think that there was a strong will against this proposed amendment. And I hope the Hong Kong government will reconsider that proposal. And they also were tying that with the China and U.S. trade war, because they think that the new tariffs is supposed to come into effect on the 15th or being renegotiated. They will call for the people of Hong Kong to keep resisting or keep interfering from the vote from taking place
right
at the legislative chamber. And hopefully, the China and U.S. trade war will be in their favor.
Evan, yeah. Thank you so much. And we're going to let Evan have the last word in this segment as we leave it there with Washington Post foreign affairs correspondent Ishan Tharoor, who is writing this week both about the tensions with Iran and the situation in Hong Kong and China. Ishan, thank you so much. So informative.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me again.